Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. Toward the end of spring, normally rational people decide to become caterers. There are graduations, weddings, showers, and they all require food. We'll get some tips on how to cope from chefs and from Liberace. So let's dig in. Kevin Weeks is a personal chef in Knoxville, Tennessee. He also teaches cooking classes and blogs at Seriously Good. He has written a piece for Kitchen Window Online about cooking for crowds. He's on the line from Knoxville. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Bonnie.
The piece you did for Kitchen Window was about cooking for crowds. And this is late spring, and this is apparently the season when everybody becomes a caterer.
Absolutely.
And you work for an online cooking consulting company. Tell me what that is.
The company is named ChefsLine.com. And what it is, we have 25 chefs spread around the country, and home cooks can call in and get advice on recipes. They can take classes over the telephone. We'll customize classes for them. They can get help on planning parties, such as the event I did. Just anything we can do as professionals to help out home cooks.
So this time of year, you get what kind of requests?
Oh, people are doing graduation parties, and weddings are coming up, and wedding showers.
Give me some typical questions.
Yeah, well, one of the worst is I'm cooking for 75 people. How much food do I need? It's sort of mind-boggling that someone has trouble figuring that out, and yet they're talking about taking on 75 people.
What do you tell that person?
That person, we usually recommend that they consider going for professional catering because it's really difficult to cook for that. As a matter of fact, I consider it impossible to cook for that many people. Without a professional kitchen, you run into problems with equipment. You don't have pots that are big enough. You don't have enough burners on the stove. You don't have enough ovens to cook for that many people unless you've got a professional kitchen.
The piece you did for Kitchen Window Online was after you put together a big party for your parents' 60th wedding anniversary. How do you begin the menu planning?
I start by choosing a main dish. That's going to be the biggest chore that I face in the course of doing the cooking. And I want something that is difficult to screw up. I want it to be easy to make for the most part. Ideally, something that's fairly low maintenance in terms of the cooking process. For instance, for my parents' meal, I chose to do a milk-braised pork loin because I had very little prep up front, and then I could stick it in the oven for 2.5 to 3 hours and just forget about it. So it's a very forgiving main course. And that leaves me time to concentrate on other things. But the other thing it did was it took over the oven for 2.5 to 3 hours, which meant that I couldn't use the oven for anything else. So that has to be taken into account. If I choose that for my main dish, then all of my side dishes need to be something I can cook on the stovetop.
You only had one oven?
That was what I thought initially. And then I found out just before the event that I had access to a second oven. At that time, I decided, well, let's do leeks because this is the season for leeks, and they're so good this time of year. And with a second oven, I could cook them at the same time as the pork. I also found some local asparagus and decided to do that.
How did you prepare those?
The asparagus, we wrapped that up in puff pastry.
Mm.
I roasted the asparagus first and then wrapped it in puff pastry and then baked it.
And you make the puff pastry?
No, I...
Oh, this is so reassuring.
Yes, I have made puff pastry once. That was enough. Pepperidge Farm does just fine for me.
And then you used rhubarb also.
Yes, rhubarb for the mousse. And, of course, this is rhubarb season.
Yeah.
You know, several years ago, I got tired of the usual rhubarb dishes. So rhubarbs and strawberry for pie and that sort of thing. And I got to thinking, and I happen to be very fond of mousse, and I thought, well, rhubarb would probably make a good mousse. And it sure does. And it's this beautiful pink color. And it's slightly tart. It's just a wonderful, refreshing dessert.
In your piece for Kitchen Window Online, you give a whole list of tips for people planning big parties like this. Just to sum up, though, what would you tell people who called in with this, asking for some guidance?
Well, I always tell people to plan their menus so that as much as possible of it is done in advance. For instance, in the case of my menu, I cooked the leeks in advance. They needed to be boiled in water for a short time before they were then baked. So I did those in advance. I cooked the beets for the salad a day in advance. Anything you can do in advance is one less thing to worry about on the day of the event, and is one less thing that can go wrong on the day of the event. And then I go through and I make sure that I don't have any conflicts in terms of cooking equipment, that I have enough burners on the stove for everything that needs to be done on the stove, that I have enough pots and pans for everything that needs to be done.
So advance planning is really...
absolutely essential. I started planning that meal a month in advance, and would go through and make notes and then go back through and and rethink everything over and over again.
And how was the meal?
It was wonderful. There was not an ounce of food left.
That's great. Kevin, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
That was Chef Kevin Weeks in Knoxville, Tennessee. Some cooks bring bling to their dinner parties. Here's NPR's Debbie Elliott with a good example.
Never underestimate a man in a sequined apron. That's the first line of a new cookbook called Joy of Liberace, Retro Recipes from America's Kitschiest Kitchen. Sure, you may remember Liberace as an over-the-top, rhinestone-encrusted piano man, but he was also a whiz in the kitchen. He loved to cook for his friends and his mother, and at one point even owned a restaurant. Authors Michael and Karen Fetter have compiled some of his favorite recipes in their new book. They join me now from, where else? Las Vegas, where they work for the Liberace Foundation. Hello, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
We're happy to be here.
Did he really wear a sequined apron?
I have seen a sequined apron. I'm working also at the museum with the costume collection, and in fact, I have personally seen Liberace's sequined apron.
Well, do me a favor and take me to dinner at Liberace's house. What am I going to see? I'm imagining there are definitely going to be candelabras on the table.
Oh, absolutely. Candelabras on the table and bling everywhere the eye could see. You'll see that he's got crystal that has been modeled after the Queen's crystal set, and he has everything set just so and to abundance.
Yeah, his table settings were really flamboyant and outrageous. It seemed like most everything had an L encrusted on it.
Well, what would have been on the menu? Who would have been the other guests?
Well, the recipe that I always remember from the cookbook is the braised oxtails recipe, which is something, you know, we don't eat a lot today. But, you know, in the 50s, I mean, that's why we call it retro recipes from America's Kitschiest Kitchen, because there is a quality of kitsch to these recipes.
Occasionally it would go wrong. He had Michael Jackson as a guest to his home, and he was very proudly had prepared a wonderful dish of chicken.
A down-home southern thing.
And, of course, it became immediately obvious that Michael Jackson is a vegetarian and wasn't going to be able to eat any of it, but it looked great nonetheless.
He really was an excellent chef, and he loved to cook. He would cook on the road. He would take his own utensils on the road so that he could cook for friends.
Oh, he had the frying pan. He had portable burners. I mean, he really would set up a little kitchen right in his
He would set it on top of the bathtub.
And his cooking kit was made by Halliburton, so it evidently was battle-tested. What's fascinating is that when you talk about mid-century modern, which was sort of where Liberace was really doing his thing, you think about an aesthetic that's very simple and very unadorned. At the same time, the food that was going on at that time was quite the opposite. People ate very large meals. They ate a lot of meat, and they cooked it in the ways that, well, we remember grandma cooking. And so what we have with Liberace is the perfect representation of this mid-century modern culture ethic of food.
What are some of the recipes that are good examples of that mid-century aesthetic?
Well, he has a wonderful salami-yami bouquet.
A salami-yami, say that again?
Salami-yami bouquet.
It's an hors d'oeuvre.
It's an hors d'oeuvre, and it's deceivingly simple. You basically take sliced salami and put into it cream cheese, but the cream cheese is all dyed different colors with food coloring and then made into a very large and wonderful bouquet.
And I see the picture now here. You have greenery hanging down.
And these salami flowers poking up.
Exactly.
Did he have a certain specialty, anything that truly reflected his over-the-top personality?
Well, I think his favorite recipes, or the ones that were made most often, were probably the Italian. The spaghetti with meat sauce. We have pictures of him making the spaghetti with meat sauce.
And meatloaf.
Yeah.
And sort of the
meatballs. He loved meatballs.
The down-home things that we would sort of call basics at the, you know, nowadays. The key here is the execution of them to include exuberance so that you know, you have the maximum fun with the dishes. What we've now called, in a sort of modern way, bling cooking. And the concept of bling cooking is really all about food where, of course, there is a substance to it. Just as Liberace was an incredibly well-skilled performer on the piano, and that was the base on which he built the exuberance, so is the same with this cooking. It has that wonderful base of a staple, but then can be executed in the blingiest way possible.
Michael and Karen Fetter are the authors of Joy of Liberace, Retro Recipes from America's Kitschiest Kitchen. To see more of Liberace's favorite dishes, visit our website, npr.org. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
My pleasure.
Whether you cook for two or for 200, disaster is always a possibility. Even the best professionals have their share of cooking disasters. Food writer and cookbook author Andrew Friedman is the co-editor of a collection of stories from some of the world's greatest chefs about their not-so-finest hours. The book is called Don't Try This at Home: Culinary Catastrophes from the World's Greatest Chefs. NPR's Leanne Hansen and Neil Conan talk with Andrew Friedman about what can happen and how to fix it.
Chefs are notoriously kind of a closed circle, kind of cliquish. Are these the stories that they've told themselves and you had to kind of draw out of them to tell you?
Well, you know, it's very funny. The stories kind of fall into several degrees of how well known they were amongst the cliques of chefs before they made it into this book. But there were actually some stories in this book that chefs had been telling, we learned when we got into it, that chefs had been telling each other for years and that it almost attained sort of legendary status, almost, if you know this, the movie The Aristocrats, and how they talk about this joke that only comedians have known for years.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Repair, who's the chef of Le Bernardin in New York City, had a story to share with us. And as we were discussing the story that he was going to put in the book, on the way out of the room, he said, you know, you really should call Michelle Richard, who's a very well-known chef in the Washington, D.C. area. And we said, well, why is that? And he said, well, Michelle has a really great story. He's been telling it for 25 years. It involves a wedding cake and two Dobermans. And we said, what's the story? And he said, call Michelle. And I said, well, we don't know Michelle personally. And he said, just call Michelle Richard. Tell him you want the cake story. And, of course, he knew exactly what that meant, and that story is in the book.
Oh, you have to tell the story. It's such a great story. It involved this huge wedding cake, and he did some blown sugar doves on the top, and the thing was huge, and he brought
Correct.
It. You know, go on. He brings it into the Sub-Zero refrigerator at
exactly.
the back of the wedding, and what happens?
Well, what happens is, long story short, he arrives at a wedding, and the wedding cake that had been ordered, the one thing that they absolutely had to have was two blown sugar doves. He's racing to get to this wedding, and this was he's in D.C. now, but at the time of the story was in Los Angeles, Beverly Hills. And when he's rounding a corner on his way to the wedding, one of the doves breaks. He gets to the wedding. He's told to put the cake in a Sub-Zero refrigerator in the garage. And as he's cramming this huge cake into this very narrow refrigerator, the shelf gives way and the cake crashes and the second dove is shattered. And what happens is he notices nearby that he's in the front of the house and the entire wedding is taking place behind the house. And he notices that the people whose house this is have two Dobermans who are in the driveway just watching this drama. And he calls them over and basically invites them by practically shoving their faces into the cake to start eating the cake. And as they're devouring the cake, he goes running for the wedding coordinator saying, and this is a very bad French accent, but this is Michel Richard, has a very pronounced accent, saying, "Madame, madame, the dogs, they ruined my cake. They ruined my cake." So he, you know, obviously he blamed it on the dogs, defenseless dogs who can't speak for themselves or tell the true story. And he then very cleverly, as many of these stories end, he triumphs. He goes out to a store, he buys some mint, he buys some whipped cream, he buys some strawberries, and he turns, because not only did the dove break, but the cake itself had been become very smushed, let's say. And he covers it with whipped cream and strawberries and mint and turns it into a giant strawberry shortcake wedding cake and becomes a hero to the people whose wedding it was, although obviously he created the situation himself.
Andrew Friedman, I have to ask you about another story that I just absolutely laughed out loud.
Yeah.
It's Claudia Fleming's story, The Blob.
The Blob.
Yeah. Can you briefly tell us that one?
Yeah, it's a funny story. And, you know, as with many of the stories in the book, what really makes it funny is the sort of mindset that these chefs are in at the time of the story. And many of the stories take place early in their careers. Claudia became one of the best-known pastry chefs in New York, best known for the work she did at Gramercy Tavern, which is one of New Yorkers' favorite restaurants probably for years now. And but the story took place, she was a pastry chef at Tribeca Grill, which is the restaurant that Robert De Niro and Drew Nieperant run downtown in New York City. And she would be alone all day in what was referred to by the other cooks there as the Sugar Tower, which was the pastry kitchen up a floor above where the rest of the kitchen facilities were, and she would be alone there all the time. And because she was alone and had a lot of work to do and was sort of feeling overwhelmed a lot, she would look for ways to shortcut things, which is very common among young cooks, to try to find your own way of doing something to save time. Oftentimes it works. This one thing she tried did not work, which was she had to whip egg whites. And instead of whipping the amount she usually did, she got this 40-gallon industrial mixer and put 8 times the amount of yolks in, and I think went down the hall for something. And when she came back, this thing had basically turned to suds, essentially, and was in this beehive formation over the vat, whereupon it falls over, starts running down the counter, coming toward the door. And it, again, the way she relates it is so funny because it's just egg whites. And she starts to have visions, though, of this creature, this egg white creature, finding its way down the stairs, through the kitchen, out into the streets of Tribeca. Or, you know, probably Robert De Niro's going to see it and wonder who the hell they hired to be their pastry chef. And she runs downstairs and finds Jerry Hayden, who was the chef de cuisine at the time at the restaurant. And she's just screaming, doesn't know what to do. And he just looks at her as he can't believe she's asking him this question. It says, "Turn off the mixer." And what she had forgotten in her moment of panic, which, again, she knew this, but she was so freaked out, was that if you just turn off the mixer, this would the volumizing would cease. And she had forgotten that, just as she forgot that if you leave egg whites to whip endlessly, they'll go way beyond what most people have probably seen, and they'll go to, you know, 8 times. I think 8 times their volume is the factor. So she runs upstairs and shuts it off. And the kind of funny P.S. to the story is, Jerry and some of the line cooks come running up to help her because she seemed so alarmed, like the world was ending. And they all just start laughing, and it became this very funny sort of in joke there. And then years later, she and Jerry reconnected at the James Beard Awards in New York and got married. So that's it's a very sweet ending to the dessert story.
There's a funny story in your book, and I'm forgetting which of the chefs tells it at this point, but it also involves a cookie and a battle between the chef and the waitstaff.
Yeah, that's Tom Valenti of West and Cheska restaurants in New York City. It's, once again, early in his career, I think actually his first time as an executive chef, and he took over a restaurant called Chelsea Central, or took over the kitchen, I should say. It was owned by somebody else. And he was replacing a very, very popular chef who was very well liked by the staff, especially the wait staff. And there was no general manager at this restaurant, so Tom essentially had to act as general manager and also as chef. And since there was no one there to sort of enforce rules on the front of the house staff, meaning the waiters and whatnot, they decided they would just ignore whatever Tom told them to do. So needless to say, this is very humbling and very frustrating to him, and there's very little recourse. And the thing that became sort of the nightly centerpiece of his anger was there was a little old-fashioned dessert trolley that they would bring around to all the tables, mm-hmm. and there were homemade cookies on this trolley, and they would somehow run out of cookies very early every evening. And the reason they were running out was that waiters would come over to make a coffee or an espresso or something for a customer. And if the dessert trolley was parked there at the moment, they would help themselves to a cookie. And it was so bad that they would literally be coming into the kitchen, you know, saying, you know, is dinner ready for table 42? And they'd have just a mouthful of cookie as they were doing it, even though he had told them time and time again not to do this. So it becomes this ongoing battle. And Tom comes up one day as he's fixing himself a coffee one morning, and he looks down at the espresso machine, and he notices or observes that the spent pods, a lot of these now come prepackaged, but if you have pods, if you have coffee grounds, espresso grounds that you tamp down into the portafilter, which is the thing through which the water runs to make an espresso, the spent grounds look not unlike a little chocolate cookie or chocolate shavings. And Tom decides, you know what? I got an idea. And he proceeds to make these little spent espresso ground patties. He presses them between his hands so they look like little cookies. And he pipes whipped cream on top. And as a little private joke for himself, he puts a little chocolate-covered espresso bean on top of that and puts a doily on a plate and arranges it as though those are the cookies for the evening. And there was this one waiter who was sort of the ringleader of the front of the house gang. They start dinner service that night, and all of us, very early in the evening, this waiter comes running into the kitchen choking on this, you know, mouthful of wet, disgusting, used espresso grounds. And Tom sort of gives him a look, and the guy sort of gives him a look like, well, you know, you got me. And the story is called The Trojan Cookie. And what's funny about it was not only was that a turning point, but Tom actually remembers this guy and most of the people who worked at that restaurant very fondly once they turned this corner. It kind of speaks to this sort of, you know, it's funny. Bill Telepan, another New York chef who's in the book, has a story called Neverland about the time he spent in a kitchen in France and this big food fight he gets into in the walk-in refrigerator there, where essentially he and a bunch of guys, instead of throwing food at each other, as he says, they throw themselves at the food because there's shelves of food all around, and they destroy the entire prep work for that night's service. But there is this sort of element in a lot of kitchens of sort of, Bill's story is called Neverland, because there's this element sort of not growing up. And, you know, Tom's triumph over those front of the house guys, it's not unlike the kind of thing, you know, you might deal with your first week of college or your first day at a new high school. You know, this sort of having to prove yourself by sort of outwitting and being more clever than your opponents. And that's how you sort of win respect. It's funny.
Those tales and many others are included in Don't Try This at Home, Culinary Catastrophes from the World's Greatest Chefs, edited by Kimberly Witherspoon and Andrew Friedman, who joined us from the studios of member station WAMC in Albany, New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That was NPR's Leanne Hansen and Neil Conan. Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and lots of recipes. Join us next time when we go to pick strawberries. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.